This evening we continue our series of talks. We now find ourselves after the second Sunday of the fast, as we would call it, and before the third Sunday of the fast. Therefore, our subject this evening will be the moral lesson of the third Sunday of the fast. This is called the Sunday of the Veneration of the Cross. As most of you know, when we speak of the Sunday of the Veneration of the Cross, we are approximately halfway through Great Lent. Whether we look back toward Clean Monday or ahead toward the end of Lent, we find ourselves at the midpoint. The Church has appointed this day for the precious and life-giving cross to be brought forth. That is why it is called the Sunday of the Veneration of the Cross, so that the faithful may venerate the cross and draw strength from it for the rest of their journey until they reach the end. Sadly, it is true that many people make no spiritual effort at all. They have not even abstained from meat, nor do they intend to. Consequently, they feel no need to seek help from anywhere. But there are also those who are truly striving, both in fasting from food and in bodily self-restraint, and they do need this help. So the Church has rightly appointed that, at the midpoint of the fast, the precious cross be lifted up for veneration, so that every believer may receive strength from it, as I have said. The cross is presented without the crucified Christ upon it. The cross with the crucified Christ is reserved for the end of this period, and specifically for Great Friday. Yet the cross reminds each person of the crucified one. And the person who thinks rightly considers what this cross is and what blessing came from it. That it is something beneficial for us to contemplate and revere is evident from the attacks that heretics direct against the cross. So then, why should a piece of wood trouble them? And yet this wood is no ordinary wood. It is the wood behind which stood the salvation of the human race. That is why Satan hates it. You yourselves have often heard, when speaking with Jehovah's Witnesses, Protestants and others, the people known among us as evangelicals, that they call it an instrument of murder, as though Satan had used the wood rather than those men. Was the wood at fault, or were those who nailed Christ to it? What fault did the wood have? Indeed, the wood was sanctified from the moment it was soaked with that divine blood. That is why we call it the precious wood. The wood is not soaked in the blood of criminals. It is soaked in the blood of Christ, in the blood of God. In itself, the wood is nothing, neither good nor evil. It is simply wood. It becomes good or evil according to how it is used. So can that which was soaked in the blood of God not be the precious wood? Satan understands this rightly, for he shudders when he sees a person who makes the sign of the cross properly, wears a cross, has anything to do with the cross, or crucifies his own self. Satan does not want this. And precisely for this reason, through his instruments, his victims, as we call them, he attacks the precious and life-giving cross. For us, this is something serious, of the utmost seriousness, because the cross is bound up with God, with the salvation of the human race, and with the crushing of Satan's head. For as you know, Satan could see as far as the cross, but he could not see what lay beyond it. That is precisely why, after the resurrection, when the priest comes out through the beautiful gate, our Church has him carry a resurrectional cross throughout the whole period until Pentecost. Behind the cross is fastened a lamp, a candle with a red ribbon. The candle belongs behind the cross. Some clergy do not pay attention and place it in front. First comes the cross, and behind it the resurrection. Satan could not see the resurrection that lay beyond the cross, and so he raised Christ upon it, certain that he was removing a righteous man from his path. He did not know about the resurrection that would spring forth behind it. That is why he hates the cross. It proved to be Satan's trap. He took the bait and swallowed it, the net, the hook. That is why he hates the cross. And you hear all the things that are done and said against the precious and life-giving cross. But for us Orthodox Christians, as I have told you, the cross is of immense importance. That is why in the middle of Great Lent, our Church raises it up and brings it forth for veneration. She also blesses flowers and distributes them to the faithful, who receive them as a blessing. The mystery of the cross is not concerned only with the wood. This form that we speak of, the cross we wear, carry, keep in our homes, or venerate in the church, has a deeper significance. Therefore, on the coming Sunday, those of us who are still here and attend church will hear a gospel reading about the cross. In it, Christ gives us a striking exhortation: "Whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me." Whoever desires, I compel no one. You should understand this. The Lord does not call anyone by force. If you think that what I preach and what I accomplish in my Orthodox Church through my Orthodox priests is for your benefit, then come. If you understand that you need it, come. I do not summon you by force. I do not compel you to become a believer or my follower. You retain your freedom so that tomorrow I may judge you. For someone to be judged, he must possess complete freedom, so that he may conduct his life accordingly and be judged justly. So he does not compel anyone or make him a Christian by force, whether he wishes it or not. If you desire, but take heed, if you desire to follow me, you will not walk ahead of me or beside me. We have nothing to debate, nor do I want to hear your clever claims. I think this or I imagine that. You will come behind me. If you agree, well and good. If you do not, go your own way. Act lawfully or unlawfully, if you wish. Eat the good things I provide, breathe my air, receive my sunlight and all its beneficial effects upon you. You may have them freely. But know this: one day the curtain will fall, and then I will bring you to judgment. Do you see what the Orthodox Church does? She has one bell, or several, and she rings them. She has never sent a policeman to pull anyone out of bed and make him come. She does not force him to come in the morning, later on, or even at the very end. Not at all. She has one entrance through which people enter, and two doors through which they leave. Come in whenever you wish, and leave whenever you wish. No one compels you. If you like it, stay. If you do not, there is the road. No one is forced. It is regrettable when some people complain, "You know, they have worn us out. There is the door. You are free to leave." But we do not grasp this as fully as we should, and that is why we often speak differently. Although Christ alone lays no burden upon us, he is also the only one who never coerces a human being. He asks, "Do you want to follow me? If you do, you will have certain obligations and certain things to take into account." For many people say they want to follow him, but they do not want to hear about any of that. Well then, in what sense do you want to follow him? If you truly want to, if you respect me, acknowledge me, and take me seriously, then surely you must listen and do what I tell you here. If you merely acknowledge me but go on doing whatever you please, that is not fitting. The two things do not go together. There are many Christians like this, and this Sunday gives each of us an opportunity to consider whether we belong to that category. The essential question is whether a person merely believes in Christ or actually does what Christ says, because the life of Christ is a continual crucifixion. To crucify means to put to death, to mortify. And here, I do not know whether you noticed, Christ is still living and is already speaking about the cross before the cross. There was no cross yet. Christ had not yet been crucified. And even so, the Lord says, "Whoever wants to come after me must take up his cross." And in fact, the evangelist Luke, who records the same incident, says he must carry his cross every day. There will be no day on which a person may cast aside his cross. Not for the Christian, because the Christian struggle is a continual crucifixion. To crucify means that I put my own will to death. I mortify my flesh, refusing to gratify it when I should not. I mortify my appetite, my self-interest, and my ego. I mortify, mortify, mortify. I put them to death. Let Christ's will be done, not mine. Let Christ's will be done, not the will of my flesh. Let Christ's will be done, not what serves my own interests. Let Christ's will be done, not what the world wants. Let Christ's will be done, not what fashion dictates. Let Christ's will be done, not Satan's. This requires a constant and unceasing struggle. Just as a bishop is called a bishop because he oversees and watches over his flock, so a person must keep watch over himself, so that Satan does not take possession of him and nothing is done that is contrary to the soul's true good. As you know, the human being is a union of soul and body. Although each needs the other for the human person to exist, the body needs the soul, and the soul also needs this shell for there to be an egg, this cage to contain the bird we call the soul. Nevertheless, each has its proper place. The soul must take precedence over the body. The soul must be the rider, and the body the carriage. The soul must be the helmsman, and the body the ship. We must never allow the body to take the soul's place, with the body becoming the rider and the soul, the beast of burden, so that whatever the body desires is done instead of what is right and truly beneficial for the soul. Then we are not bearing the cross. Then my own will has not been crucified or put to death. I belong to someone else, to one who, if we examine the matter, does not truly seek my good. This is why Christ once called this generation adulterous and sinful. When is a woman called an adulteress, or a man an adulterer? When he abandons his lawful wife and enters into an illicit relationship with another woman or with another man, then he is called an adulterer. A father of the church says this concerning the matter. The one who sacrifices the truth, an adulteress, he says, is a generation that has forsaken God and clung to Satan. The soul that has abandoned God, abandoned the will of God, abandoned the teaching of God's gospel, abandoned the Church of Christ and attached itself to the outlook of Satan, the world, the ego, self-interest, and the flesh, that soul is called an adulteress. And sadly, there are many such souls today. They bear the name of Christian, but their lives, the goods they actually offer, are purely satanic. Take, for example, this simple fast of these days. Who keeps it? Work it out. Out of every 100 Christians, 2 to 5 keep this fast, and the rest, with their own theories, their own religion, where do they end up? Who practices abstinence during these days? Which married couples do so? For when we speak of fasting, we mean both fasting from food and bodily abstinence. Who makes even this small sacrifice for a few days? Will it harm you? No, it will not. It is even beneficial to your health. Both forms of fasting are something great. Who has undertaken such a struggle? Only a very small number struggle in this way, either because they never intend to make the effort at all, or because their partner or spouse is not of one mind with them in this matter. In reality, no effort is made, and consequently, no spiritual benefit is gained. And now we're confident that we're Christians, and that one day we'll get there and pass inside too. That's a mistake. We won't get in, because it isn't enough just to have the sign over a shop, honesty, when it robs you the moment you walk in. What good is it that honesty is written outside? Whatever the sign may say, it means nothing if the goods inside, or the conduct of the person inside, do not correspond to the name on the sign. Is there any name more beautiful than that of Christian? There is no more beautiful name. But who truly possesses the Christianity proclaimed by Christ? Whose name we bear, we Christians have taken this name. We carry it as our title. There is no name more beautiful than that of Christian, and yet in practice Christianity is absent. So the day after tomorrow, like the Sunday of Orthodoxy, offers us an opportunity. It should call us to stop and ask ourselves how we stand before these few words of Christ, "Whoever desires to come after me." Are there not Christians among us, perhaps even here tonight, whose opinions differ from those of the Church and from the Gospel? They hold an opinion different from the gospel. They hold an opinion different from Christ's. Christ says to the young woman and to the young man, "Self-control, chastity, until the day you marry." That is what he says, and then he crowns him for the self-control he kept. They are called crones precisely because he struggled for it. And people say, "These things are impossible." Well, if that is so, then Christ is lying, and the gospel is lying. They say things, people tell us, that nobody can seriously put into practice, and then you're supposed to go and be a Christian. How many lies do you think they tell you? A woman marries but has no children. Is she a Christian simply because the documents call her one, or because she was crowned in an Orthodox wedding? How can she refuse this? Is it really possible? Of course it is. Return to your kingdom. Remain in your home. Do not listen to the world which repeatedly draws you out of your kingdom and sends you where you ought not to go. then you will see that your body can bring forth these little children, 1, 2, 3, 5. This is the purpose. But if you insist on doing things your own way, following new theories that lie outside Christian and upright morals and customs, then naturally you will stumble. And then you blame the gospel, the priest, Christ, and the church, because they stand opposed to you. In reality, however, they are not to blame. It is a cross. It will bind you to your home. The family is a cross. Children are a cross. But you must carry that cross. When you and your spouse drank from the common cup given to you by the priest, that was what it meant. The wine was not merely something sweet. It is the cup of tribulations. It is the cup of motherhood. It is the cup of bearing children. Evangelia, you will remain there through the night, holding the syringe and giving medicine to your child. This is the cup of tribulations. A spouse is called a spouse because husband and wife have entered beneath the same yoke to plow together. Yet both you and your husband have cast off that yoke. Are you a Christian? Can you take what belongs to Christianity and then fashion your own gospel and your own religion? You are not carrying the cross. You have thrown the cross away. Christ placed the cross upon you, because the cross is a yoke. Set a cross before you and place your head here beneath it, you as one spouse, and let the other place their head on the other side. At once it becomes a yoke in the form of a cross, but you throw the cross away. Do I want such a thing? Very well. Change yourself, grow spiritually, desire what belongs to Christ, and do it. You seek only your own pleasure, but there is more to come after this life. If we were not first going to die, or if afterward we were going to some paradise of our own making, I could understand it. We might do whatever we wished, but we will die, and we will go either to the paradise or to the hell that God has appointed, according to whether we are believers or unbelievers. That reality ought in some measure to bring us to our senses. So the Sunday that comes the day after tomorrow, here at the midpoint of the fast, is a Sunday carrying many responsibilities. How many people believe only in their own way? And how many people mint their own coinage of opinion? I think, I imagine, I, who are you to be thinking and imagining? You are completely full of your own imagination. You are not called to think things up, and you are not called to imagine them either. You are called to believe the one who knows better. You have been called, so fall in behind him. Man is filled with egotism. He places himself even ahead of God, the all-wise God, the Creator. He goes before him. He makes laws, creates new arrangements, invents fashions, and produces astonishing things, all in an attempt to manufacture happiness. And since man has achieved so many technical wonders with which he thinks he can create happiness, have suicides ceased? Have the psychiatric hospitals emptied? They are full. There are more suicides now than there have ever been in the whole history of mankind. Today, with all this luxury, with all these conveniences, with all this money, there is not one material good that we lack today. The suicides we have today, the mental asylums we have today, the drugs that are sold today, none of this has ever existed anywhere on this earth before. Man does not create happiness. Why? Because he is building his own. He builds his own civilization without Christ. Suicides. His own family is without Christ. And wherever Christ is absent, there is misery. This is a grave matter. It is for man's own good to walk behind Christ. That makes the way easier. I do not know whether you have ever found yourself at the back of a trolley bus or bus while the conductor insists, "Exit from the front." How do you feel then? You wonder, "How am I going to get all the way down there?" And if you are carrying something in your hands, how difficult it is. When you ask the man in front of you, "Are you getting off, sir?" and he says, "Yes, we're getting off," ah, then your heart settles back into place. Leave it to him. He'll do the pushing. And you fall in behind him, and off you go. That is Christ. Blessed are the people who put Christ out in front. They do not go ahead of him, offering clever remarks and telling him how things ought to be done, as though God had made a mistake. They say that God did not know how many people would exist, that there is not enough for everyone to live, and therefore we must cast away our children and prevent them from being born, lest people become unhappy. 300,000 are killed by their mothers each year here. in this land ruled by the devil, 300,000 premeditated killings. Is there really no room? I need not take you abroad. Go out into the countryside and see. Everywhere has been left deserted. Everything has been abandoned. It has all been left desolate. How can they say there is no room for us to live? I do not know how many more people Australia could support or how many billions could live in Africa. Who says that we cannot all live? Who says such things does God not know? God knows, but we do not listen to God, we forbid Him. We act as though He has no say in the matter, and we treat our most holy Theotokos the same way. She has no say, she is supposed to remain the most holy Theotokos, but only as a servant. When something happens to me, I cry, Most Holy Theotokos, help me. Otherwise, I cast her out. You have no business here. Sit over there with your candle and your vigil lamp. You have no power. She has no power. And yet he is a Christian, and they are Christians. How can they be? If something happens, they cry, My Most Holy Theotokos, I will wear black for a whole year. But as soon as the mourning clothes come off, they turn into black trousers and out goes the Most Holy Theotokos. That is what we are like. Everyone examines you. As for me, I am only filling the air with words. The whole matter may provoke laughter, but it is true. But if what I am saying is true, then woe to us when the day of judgment comes, for Christ does not compromise with our ways. He showed us his own way, and he lived that way himself. He bore the cross, he crucified himself. They called Christ mad. Did they not call him mad? He is beside himself, it says. Read Mark 3:21 and see. They called Christ mad. They called Christ demon-possessed. He casts out demons by Beelzebul, the ruler of the demons. He is demon-possessed, they said. They said this about Christ. Are we willing to endure the same? No, we are not. That is why we side with the world. Just imagine, madam, that you put on long trousers. They will call you mad and backward, and you have no desire to resist them, no desire to bear this pain as your cross. It is the same with a young man and with everyone else. And so we surrender ourselves to the other side. And what then becomes of the soul? It becomes an adulteress. The soul was betrothed at baptism, but it committed adultery, and now it is an adulteress with the devil. Back then, down there at the font, speaking through the person of the godparent, it said, I renounce Satan and I unite myself to Christ. But once the person had grown up a little, they turned it around and said it backwards. I renounce Christ and I unite myself to Satan, and that is what people do today. They join themselves to the devil and not to God. That is where the whole great irony lies. We make a great fuss about being Orthodox Christians, and sometimes we take it badly when someone tells us that we are not Christians, but it is from the life of each person that his faith becomes visible. From the fruit that a tree bears, you can see its health. You can see what the reality really is. So if the life we lead doesn't match the one we profess, the one whose very name we bear, then that is something we need to take seriously. Stand in simplicity before what God says. Set your cleverness aside. Put Him in front of you. Do not listen to the world. The whole world lies in the power of the evil one. Someone may say that a person should rely upon himself. No, not upon himself. He must rely upon Christ. Christ gives His promises to people, but only when they rest in Him. The fathers put it in two words. Hearing for hearing. God will hear you, your concerns and your petitions, provided that you hear Him. If a person does not listen to God, neither does God listen to that person. But when a person listens to God, God also listens to him. For example, I once met a man. He greeted me and I could see that he was a man of faith. Then he went on his way. Another man came up to me and said, Do you know what that man is? He is a saint. Glory to God, there are saints even on earth. Sit down, he said, and let me tell you, that man had 5 daughters. 6, I do not remember how many he told me. Then his relatives, fellow villagers, acquaintances, friends, and all the rest began saying, You poor wretch, what have you done? What are you going to do with all those girls? They embittered the man. Instead of telling him God will provide, they discouraged him, driving him to curse the hour and blaspheme God. Then this simple man got up and went to the church, stood before Christ, and said to him, Lord, when you gave me the first daughter, I said to you, Glory to God, you gave me the second, and again I said, Glory to God. You gave me the third, glory be to your name. You gave me the fourth, and I said the same, then the fifth, and so on. You know that they have grown up now and wish to marry. I cannot provide any of the things they need, and you know what the world is doing to me. Every day they stab me in the heart. Take charge of them, I will trouble myself no more. Take charge of them. You gave them to me, now take care of them. Does such faith exist in life today? Within 2 years they were all married. Who believes such things? Who believes them? People say, if you do not open your house, if you do not hold a party, if prospective bridegrooms do not come in, and so forth, your daughter will be left on the shelf. You don't believe in God? You won't leave this in God's hands. There was another old man who had sown, and what he sowed was his children's bread. He had no seed to spare. It was the children's bread that he sowed, so that if he got any harvest, the children would eat and he would have seed again. And no rain came. There was a drought. The ants were going to eat the seed. It was complete disaster. He gets up and goes out to his field. There was a big stone there. He takes off the little fez he was wearing, a little cap, and he sets it down on top of the stone. Then he kneels and says to God, Now listen, he says, It was with faith in you that I sowed this crop. It was my children's bread, the bread by which we could have lived. I could have lived another 2 or 3 months. You take responsibility for this, and know this. If I were George, if I were God, and you were George, I would never do such a thing to you. Now if you have the heart to let my children die, then do as you see fit. He picks up his cap and leaves. Before he could even reach the village, a torrential rain began. Did it rain only for his sake or for everyone? Who believes in God and who never believes in God? Do miracles not happen every day? Every day there are constant miracles. Are we not ourselves, many of us, the children of large families? I am one of my mother's 12 children. My wife is one of her mother's 12 children. I work. I'm 61 years old, and I've been working since I was 9. Glory to God. So why should I have only one child now and not 10? But how will the children live? How will they live? The children do live. Tell me, what about those who deliberately choose to have only a few? It is one thing if I am unable to have children, or if God does not grant me children. That is an entirely different matter. But I have the evidence before me. I am one of 12 children, and all of us lived. 5 or 6 of them today hold important positions. They are generals, distinguished people, and they have money, jobs, and so forth. Why should they not work? And why should I prevent a human life from coming into the world, perhaps an inventor, a doctor, or any number of other things? Why? Who am I to push myself to the front instead of walking behind Christ, who says, I will never leave you nor forsake you? Your mother, he says, may forget you. She may become absorbed in a telephone conversation or lean out of the window looking outside while you catch fire and are burned. But I, he says, have engraved you upon the palm of my hand. I will never leave you nor forsake you. Or do we not believe this? In truth, we do not really believe it. And yet it is true. How, then, can this be? Of course, the Christian path does not take you along a broad avenue. It does not lead you past the shop windows, through the nightclubs, or among the fashionable people of the world. It does not, and that is the truth. The road along which Christ leads you is narrow, but the road along which Christ leads you is safe. Christ. Go near those who live their lives far from Christ, who have pushed Christ aside, and say to him, Move aside and let me pass. There are many people who push him aside and pay no attention to him at all. They cast aside everything he has established, all the boundaries he has placed around the human person, like a protective fence that keeps him from being destroyed and lost, so that they can live as they please. Such people have shed bitter tears. they lose their sanity, wandering along the road and talking to themselves. They cannot sleep. If they are honest, they will admit that they have failed far from Christ. Everything we read about each day, all the troubles that fill the world, shows that Christ was pushed aside and people put themselves first. They did not want to postpone Christ. And if families have been shipwrecked, it is because they did not put Christ first. They themselves stepped in front of Christ. Away from Christ, you brought your little children into the world. But did you ask God what each one ought to become? Or do you simply do whatever the uncle says, or the godfather, or the brother-in-law? Make him this, they say, and that is what we shall make him. But is that what he is meant to become? He may be suited to shining shoes in Omonia Square. What are you going to make of him? A blockhead. He is not suited for it. God has not given him that talent. It is God who gives the talents. And if he has given your child a particular talent, how do you regard it? You put him in there with a milk tin, and he senses the others. You see it even with a little child. What will you make of him? A lawyer, an engineer. He will fail if you let him go in that direction. You see a young girl and notice what she naturally inclines toward. What will become of her? Let her find the field suited to her. How do you know? God has given the talent. Do not put yourself first. If you impose your own clever plans, you will fail. Yet a person still insists on having his own way and pursuing his own ambition. Christ must be moved out of the way, and then that person comes face to face with his failure, but refuses to admit it. He does not want to understand it. This world is a cross. The world will write you off. The world will call you mad and backward. The world will not give you its certificate of approval. But you have no need of the world's approval. What good is it to you? If this world learns that you have contracted tuberculosis, it will not come to see you. This very world with which you eat, drink, and sin, once it hears that you have tuberculosis, it will not come to see you. What then is the world? Where is the world? The only ones who remain with you are a true Christian and God. He will remain with you. Everyone else will abandon you. That is why you must take very seriously everything God has said to comfort mankind. The families we meet today would have paradise in their homes if they knew how to place Christ at the heart of their lives. But they must have humility, and that humility is lacking. My child, what is your child? Is he greater than Christ, who is a carpenter? Tell me, what is your child supposed to become? Is he greater than Paul, who was a tent maker and made tents? Truly, what is he? Tell me, what is your son or your daughter? What are they? If the soul is going to be lost, what does it matter? Let her become a washerwoman, what of it? But where is our good sense? We imagine that we will remain here, that we came for this world, and that this world is our destination. No, my beloved, we are not made for here. We came for the world to come. Here we are merely taking our examinations. We are travelers and sojourners. We are tenants of the earth. We are not permanent residents. Don't listen to those liars who tell us that we are inhabitants of the earth. We are tenants of the earth. The moment the landlord evicts you, out you go. We have come here to a foreign country. We brought nothing with us when we came, and we will take nothing with us when we go. Where are you then? Think about it deeply for a moment. Who is deceiving you by telling you that you belong here on earth? Are you truly an inhabitant of the earth? You are suspended between heaven and earth. What inhabitant of the earth are you? Where are you? If trains are departing for eternity from this very moment, then where is your philosophy? Where is your knowledge? And where is all your success in this matter? Since death is so uncertain and man's stay here so fleeting, why should you not reflect deeply on it? Why should you not think seriously? What will others say about me? It is to my advantage to be with God. And even if there were no God, I would still have lost nothing. But if God exists, I will have gained everything. That is the matter in a few words. But you who have said that God does not exist, if he does, you have lost everything. I have lost nothing. At most, I believed and enjoyed better health than you. Perhaps I will even live 5 years longer than you. I did not commit fornication. I did not steal. In this way, I escaped having those I wronged cut me open with a knife and string my entrails together like worry beads. Those lying there in the grave, I never jumped over any fences, I never stole, and so I got off easy. That rice they serve you in Korydallos prison, I never went to prison, you did. If a person really thinks it through, he'll find that he's the one who is out of his mind, in reality, when he refuses to believe. Here is something that promises him eternity, and it costs him nothing, it takes nothing away from him. On the contrary, it sets his mind right, it makes him sober and self-controlled, it makes him blessed. He goes to bed early, he gets up in the morning, he has his health, he keeps a guard on his mouth, and he isn't afraid of the taxman. Such a man does not fear moneylenders, the police, or anything else. He lives out his years peacefully and pleasantly, like a lazy dog lying there and enjoying everything. The other man, by contrast, is troubled day and night. Satan is a sadist toward those who belong to him, tormenting them with jealousy, envy, painful experiences, fears, and all the rest. But where is wisdom in all this? It is said that there was once a powerful unbeliever who had many servants. Among them was a Christian, a true Christian. They regarded him as the comic figure of the household. The others, of course, thought themselves very clever. Well, one day, they agreed to hold a celebration there in the mansion and to award a staff to the most foolish person in the company, one of those amusements people commonly devise. So the celebration took place as planned, and they asked, "Who is the most foolish? Who is the dullest? Who is the greatest fool?" "George, the Christian. He is the greatest fool. All the others imagined themselves wise." And so, in a formal ceremony, they presented him with the staff of foolishness. George took it and said, "Thank you." They applauded him, and he withdrew to his room. A considerable time passed, and then he learned that his master, the unbeliever, had fallen ill. He saw the doctors coming and going. He also saw the officers, attendants, and others looking troubled and downcast because of his master's condition. One day he asked someone, "Is it true that the master is ill?" "Yes, George, he is." "Could I go and see him too?" "I will ask," the man replied. The man thought that George would probably cheer the sick man up, since he was regarded as the comic figure of the company. Yes, perhaps he would bring him some joy. So this official, who had access even to the king, approached the matter tactfully. He said to him, "You know George has expressed a desire to visit you. What would you say to that?" "Yes," he answered, "yes." So George was told to get ready, put on his formal uniform, and go to him. And he took the staff with him, because by then he carried it wherever he went, the staff of foolishness they had given him. So George took the staff, dressed in his formal attire, and came before the king, who was ill. All the officials were gathered around him. "Welcome, George, welcome. My master," George said, "I heard that you were ill." "And I was grieved, truly grieved. For so many days I was ashamed to ask. I kept wondering whether you would receive me." "Would I not receive you, George?" "Of course I would receive you. But my master, I can see that you are in a bad way, very bad indeed." "Yes, that is what the doctors say. They do not tell me plainly, but I understand, George. Perhaps you are about to go on a journey, perhaps you really are about to depart." This was some consolation. It lifted the sick man's heart. "Well, who knows exactly how things stand?" the master replied. George said, "My master, have you made any arrangements? Have you sent word for them to expect you over there? Have you notified anyone?" Now it should be noted that George was not permitted to give that staff away to anyone unless he found someone more foolish than himself. That was the whole point of the game. For the time being, George was the fool. "George, you are not allowed to part with this staff for as long as you live, unless you find someone more foolish than yourself. Then you may give it to him." So as George spoke with the king, when he asked whether he might soon be making that journey, and whether he had made any arrangements for his arrival there, the king answered, "I have done nothing, George. I am exactly as you see me." "So you have made no preparation at all for your departure?" George asked. "Forgive me, my king," he said. "Take this staff, because in all the time I have had it from you, I have never found anyone more foolish than you." He left the staff there and departed. Yes, however amusing the story may seem, it contains a lesson and a teaching. Do not listen to those who say, "You should live like a human being." Allow me to say that very often the person who claims to live like a human being is actually living beneath the level of a human being. Does the person who says, "I am going to live like a human being," truly live? Or the one who boasts, "I lived in the mud, I lived a hard life, and my hands are calloused from manual labor"? Is that what it means to live like a human being? Draw near to many such people and see what beasts they are. See what lies within their inner world. Then you will understand the mistake. A person is not made by his occupation. It is the person who gives character to the occupation. When we ask whose hand we should lean upon and hold on to, what do we ask? Is he an officer? Is he a ship owner? What is he? No, sir. An occupation does not honor a person. The person honors the occupation. The people I mentioned to you earlier remind us of precisely this. The Christian life is difficult, but its end is joyful. For the sake of that end, every sacrifice is worthwhile, and every cross is worth carrying all the way to the grave, by the young man and the young woman, by the father and the mother, by the businessman and the priest, and by everyone. It is certainly worthwhile for a person to bear this cross, upon which the world will crucify him, while he in turn crucifies the world. Die to the world, and the world will write you off. Write off the world yourself, and you will be delivered from it. Why do you let other people's opinion trouble you? Let God's opinion be what troubles you, Paul said. The world has been crucified to me, and I to the world. The world has written me off, and I have written the world off. Leave me in peace, I'm going about my own work. Why do you take the world into account? Why are you so eager to draw out what the world thinks of you? First find out what God thinks of you at this very moment. That should make your knees tremble and cure you of caring what the world thinks. God has the power to surround you with people who will be sufficient for your needs in this temporary life. Yet you concern yourself with the world. The world is wicked. God did not say, "Beware of wild beasts," he said, "Beware of men." You see someone who has a human appearance, but inwardly he is a beast, and often not just one beast. Within many people there is an entire zoo. You know what the lives of many people are like, unless you have yet to gain experience of such persons. So do not seek to make terms with the flesh, which demands what it wants and is always whining. You know, patristic writings call the flesh an antlion, just as they call Satan one. If you indulge the flesh, it becomes a beast. If you do not indulge it, it grumbles and whimpers. It imagines illness, weakness, and dizziness, and makes itself as small as an ant. It is an antlion, but it is up to you to govern it. Say to it, "Stay where you belong and serve me." "I will not serve you. You will serve me as I command." A person must become master of himself. He must become an emperor. An emperor is not merely someone who bears that title. The true emperor is the one who exercises mastery over himself, who succeeds in directing himself rightly so that he is not destroyed and does not perish. If he lets go of the reins and allows the flesh, self-interest, the ego, the world, and all the rest to take control, he is ruined. He will not reach the end. He will not finish the course. It is therefore to my benefit to put Christ in front and follow behind him. That brings rest, because he goes before me, and when he tells me, "Yes, do this, let the child pursue these studies, undertake this business, enter this partnership, make this journey," and so forth, then you may know that everything will succeed. It may not succeed according to the world's standards, because the world wants something different from you. But if it succeeds according to God, then it is blessed. In order to remain on the right path that God desires, you will often come into conflict not only with yourself, not only with your self-interest, your flesh, your ego, and the fashions you follow, but also with those closest to you. Pay attention. I will place a measuring rod in your hands. Do you want to see how far you have advanced in the Christian life? or how firmly you stand, you can tell by how many people have abandoned you. If you still have the same male and female friends, move in the same circles, and attend the same social gatherings, then you have not taken a single step in the Christian life. From the moment you resolve to remain a true Christian and do what is right, strangers will begin to abandon you, and even your own people will do the same. Even your brothers and sisters will write you off. You will stop receiving visits. They will no longer come to see you. They will stop telephoning you and doing such things. Their number will dwindle. And the more you see your former friends falling away, the more you should know that you are following behind Christ. As long as you keep all the same friendships, know that you do not possess even a finger's breadth of the Christian life you ought to have. You will stand against the world when you lose the friendship of the world. If you want to save your soul, you will often have to surrender your life. If you do not give up this temporary false life and allow it to wither away, you will lose your soul. Many people yield in such matters. They fear the world and lose their souls. Let me give a simple example. The day after tomorrow is the Annunciation. It is the name day of Evangelos and Evangelia. What will they serve? What will they serve if they receive visitors? What will they serve? Normally they should serve fasting food, but someone will take offense. Indeed, someone is bound to take offense. So what will they do? They will drive Christ out of the house. Out, Christ! I have people here. I have guests. Someone must be offended. Better that I offend you, Christ, and the most holy Theotokos, your mother, and the angel who brought me the feast, than that I offend the world. It is a difficult crossroads. We must struggle against a brutish world that will have its own say. And yet you must hold fast to what is right and proclaim your faith. Are we not in Great Lent? Come as soon as Pascha is over, and I will have two lambs prepared for us to eat. But for now, you will have your little piece of baklava. So now you have gone to visit someone, and the other woman who does not keep the fast serves you and puts a slice of cake right into your hand. What are you going to do? I don't want to embarrass her, so I'll eat it. Really? It will devour you. You will not devour it. Please forgive me, but I cannot accept it. I am fasting. It is Great Lent. There is no but should I offend them? I do not want you to offend them. Do not go. For God's sake, if you do not know what will be served there, do not go and put either yourself or her in an awkward position. Say over the telephone, I am sorry, but I cannot come. I will visit at the first opportunity. Many happy returns, and do not go. But how can I do that? You must struggle, my friend, so that the other person may learn, and you too may learn to do what is right. If, then, we do not struggle against the world and against these established conventions, we must not cause offense, and so forth. We end up preferring to offend Christ, driving him, the most holy Theotokos, and the saint whose feast it is out of our home, just so that we may hold on to this person, that person, and another, people who often make you want to hold your nose. Some people come to offer us their greetings, or we go to greet them, and we say many years, only for them to go on doing the same things. This is a disgrace for us if we call ourselves Christians. It is a cross, then, and each person must take up that cross. You will fast, and they will mock you at work and say all sorts of things to you. Never mind. Listen and endure the insults. Christ did not answer those who accused him. He remained silent. This cross takes many forms. A mother bears children, and all the beasts gather outside, accusing her and calling her mad. They insult the married couple because they have children, and so forth. This is a great thing. You must carry your cross. Blessed are those who carry their cross in this life, so that when they die and a cross is placed upon their coffin, that cross upon the coffin may truly mean something. It is an honor for a person to have a cross above his head, upon his coffin. It is an honor, but it will be a double honor, a many times greater honor, and a true honor if that person made use of the cross throughout his life. Otherwise, at the judgment, when the graves are opened, that cross will remain there blackened like charcoal. it will not shine, nor will that grave open and send forth a dove, even though the precious cross rested upon it. That, more or less, and in summary, is the meaning of this Sunday. And let those who intend to feast heavily the day after tomorrow take care. They say that people may eat richly that day. Why? Because they ate that way yesterday, or because they will eat that way the following day. They ate that way neither yesterday nor will they the following day. On all these Sundays, only oil is permitted. Do not listen to the world and be led astray. They say it is the Sunday of the veneration of the cross, so people may feast. Why did they feast the other day? Because it was supposedly the Sunday of the veneration of the cross. Those were falsehoods of our own making and the result of our own ignorance.